Yes, welcome back to the GTT podcast. I'm your host, Dan Lowry, and today I'll be talking with my good friend and fellow Tasmanian, Jack Boone. Jack is the founder of Grip Personal Training Studio in Melbourne, and in more recent times, his latest venture, Jungle HQ. Jack is also an excellent strength coach and fitness professional with an amazing knowledge and skill set on all things training, nutrition, and fitness. If you're in Melbourne, once you get out of this hideous lockdown, or maybe by the time you're listening to this one, it's post-lockdown, you should definitely go and check out his private training studio, Jungle HQ. It is a place of excellence and amazing culture, and certainly somewhere I would train if I was living in that city. All right, I hope you enjoy the episode. Welcome to the show, Jack Boone.
Thank you for having me, mate. It's good to talk to you again.
You too, mate, always. So let's address the elephant in the Boone room. With a name like Boone, you got to confirm for us what's the relevance or what's the relation to the great Aussie sporting icon.
Oh, you wanted to start there, did you?
Let's start there, just so we can get it out of the way for all us cricket tragics.
So you want to start on the thing that you know I least like talking about.
That's it. Knock it over.
Yes, that's my former Test great father, David Boone. So it was quite a unique experience growing up in that environment. But to me, he was, I'm very proud of the things that he achieved on the sporting field. But, you know, and I was always asked these things growing up. What's it like having, you know, David as your dad? But to me, that's exactly what he was. He was my dad. And despite the things that he's achieved on the sporting field, I think there's one thing that he's done better, and that's been a good father to me and my sisters. So I'm very grateful for the childhood that I had.
Yeah, amazing, mate. We might touch on that later on. We'll see how we go. But one of the questions I always ask people on the show is how you got into training. So sport was obviously a big part of your upbringing, but how did you get into the physical fitness side of it and become a personal trainer?
Well, like we said, I too grew up in Tassie and was very involved in sport through school. So I played about everything I could with the ball, whether that be soccer, football, whether it be water polo. I did athletics. Anything that was active, I obviously enjoyed. I was always a little bit of a short and stocky fella growing up through school, and even just mucking around in those fields of exercise, discovered that I had some attributes that were probably gave me an advantage with strength. And I think, like a lot of things, you naturally gravitate towards the things that you find yourself excelling at. And that found me interested in the gym and my biceps at a pretty young age. And I think I had a mum bought me a set of adjustable dumbbells, probably would have been close to 10 or 11 years old. And I used to pump out some curls and push-ups in the bedroom before bed every night. Like, I think it's a pretty common story for a lot of us. And then found my way into the old university gym in Hobart, probably around, I reckon, 13 years old, would go down in breaks at school or sneak off or go afterwards. And that gym was pretty, it was pretty hardcore, to be honest. You had to go through a steel cage to get into the actual gym. You put a coupon in there, and it had the iron cast plates. A lot of the benches were sort of upholstered and done up with duct tape where they'd been tearing. And there was some pretty serious kind of meatheads in that gym. And that was my first environment in the weight room. And I was just like a kid in a candy store, really. I just was sponging everything, observing, and, being a little pest and asking lots of questions. And fortunately, had a few guys to show me a few things. And then it just was a natural progression from there with sport. And it was a good personal training was a good job to, in terms of like hourly rate while I was still finishing up school and starting a university degree, which I was kind of following blindly because I just was doing what my friends were doing, or I'd watched Wall Street too many times. And then I sort of had some circumstances in my life that sort of changed my, or gave me a bit of a paradigm shift, and made me look at what I was doing differently in the opportunity. So without naming other people's names, I think I was probably between the ages of 16 and 20. I had two women, young women, that were present in my life develop pretty severe depression, which was brought on or really magnified by probably body image disorders and eating disorders. And as a young male with inexperience, I was very confused about why these things were occurring, why they were taking place, because in my eyes, they were nothing but beautiful the way they were. And it's very hard to see people that you care about have so much pain and dislike towards themselves for reasons that you can't understand. So that sort of paved a little bit of a niche for me to start diving and digging further into my own research and an overwhelming desire to help and provide positive influence on those that may be heading down a similar path or have wrestled with those things at some stage in their life as well.
Yeah, cool. Man, I remember that gym, uni gym, when I was in the army and I'd come back on leave. I used to go in there and train. It was sort of pre-Zap days before there was any other real options. I think at one point you sort of had uni gym, the aquatic center up at Domain.
Yeah.
There might have been one or two other gyms around, but there really wasn't much, was there?
No, there wasn't. So that was a great gym. Mm. And they did a lot of renovations, I think, as like you said, the Zaps sort of started to take over the Hobart commercial gym space. And then, you know, probably more recently, in the last maybe 5 years or so, the group training facilities really sort of started to become popular, and they completely cut out the guts and soul of what made that place fantastic, and have sort of made this, you know, really safe, friendly environment in it, which is a shame, but that's just my own biased opinion.
Yeah, I mean, being a business guy yourself, you'll probably appreciate it as much as I do. I mean, you know, I started in fitness for pretty similar reasons to you. I played a lot of sport, you know, love sport. I just wasn't quite good enough, I don't think, to ever have made anything at it. You know, state underage cricket, I was always like the 13th or 14th guy in my age group. And I sort of stopped playing when I was 17, and I went to the army anyway. So I didn't really get to see how that would have turned out. But I got into fitness because I love sport so much, and it was just, I think for anyone who is competitive, going into the gym was just like a natural extension of trying to get that extra edge for whatever you're playing. And you'd watch AFL footy on the weekend and you'd see the guys who are muscled up and you're like, all right, that's the edge. That's the obvious edge I can get for playing footy or whatever it is. Yep. But, you know, after being in the fitness industry for a number of years, the thing that really started to invoke my interest was the business side of it, the business models, the trends, and what's working. And, yeah, like the last, I think the last 7 years, 7 to 10 years, the whole group training thing has gone crazy. I mean, when we started GTT, since we started GTT, I think in that time in Hobart, just within the immediate sort of Hobart area, there's at least 10 more group training type gyms that have come in after that.
But you were definitely probably the founder of that in Hobart in many ways.
I think probably the first guy was Drummond Williamson with CrossFit 42. So that was the first existing group training thing. I mean, CrossFit's obviously a little bit of a world of its own.
But that CrossFit probably had a fair influence on this shift in direction, you'd have to say.
Definitely, definitely. So I think what the fitness industry started to realize pretty quickly when they looked at CrossFit was it would be a really, really good business model if you did it pretty much exactly the same, but just less intimidating.
Yeah, just change the change the delivery a little bit, or the principles within the service.
Yeah, you just make it a little easier.
Mm.
And I mean, that's basically what our team training program is. We don't do cleans, we don't do snatches, we don't do any Olympic lifting or super high rep stuff. We just do strength and we do conditioning, and so that balance in a scaled down version works really well for most people.
Yeah, no, it's interesting what you said before about you know, sport and how you felt about yourself in terms of maybe not quite being good enough to make it at the top level, despite your love for the games or whatever they were. But I reckon this is quite a common story as well. Other than me just enjoying the gym and seeing its benefits that it would have to sport for me, but it was very much an outlet. I mean, you, as a teenage man, you've got a lot of hormones running through your body. You've got a lot of emotional immaturity and probably inability to sort of process those emotions and situations. And I think at times my unique circumstances growing up in a small place like Hobart, as you addressed at the start of the podcast, with a surname that was well recognised, that came with its own pressures. And I don't think, and it's interesting now, having had more life experience and having grown up and learned more as well in the space of coaching, is that I feel like I did have enough ability when it came to skill. But what I recognize now, and what I feel frustrated about, I guess, from perhaps other coaches that had the opportunity to help me when I was younger, was I very clearly had like a performance anxiety and probably crippling fear, which obviously hindered performance massively, especially in the game of cricket, because there's nowhere to hide in cricket. You're one-on-one out in the middle of the pitch, and it's in football, you know, you've got a team around you, and you know, you can hide if you're having a bad day and such things like that. And it's just, you know, I went from being in the nets training and performing as good as anyone could ask you to, but it's a whole nother ball game when you're in the center of the field there, and you feel your expectations to live up to those surnames and feel those footsteps, whether that be internal expectations or ones from other people around me. So, again, just my own experiences have triggered my curiosity and fascination to explore that further, and the impacts that the physiological effects that come from the psychological experience.
Yeah, totally. And that's I think the really unique thing about cricket is that you've got to walk that line between caring enough to focus but not caring so much it becomes a crippling, debilitating force in your ability to execute your skills. And this was something I learned so much about in the army through all my training there, because it was all drill based. It was all about shutting off that conscious part of your brain to a large degree and just drilling so much that everything became autonomous. And I can certainly relate to that in cricket. I mean, I probably went through a whole thing where, I think the first thing to understand is, you know, as a male, until you're 25, you're pretty much half retarded, you know, especially
maybe,
emotionally.
Maybe three quarters.
Yeah, well, definitely. So, you know, you're battling with all that sort of stuff. And, you know, I remember like year seven, I was the captain of, you know, the Southern Schoolboys team when you play that. And I had the belief, but then I went out and just wasn't performing. And then that crept in and it literally sunk into my brain for years. And I was the same. I had it all in the nets, but I just wasn't putting it together out on the field. And I remember my last year of cricket before I went to the army was 97, 98. So I played about half the year in first grade, half the year in second grade. And I actually had a really good year because I'd sort of come to this point with myself where it was like, fuck it. You know, what does it matter? And just had this sort of this reckless abandon about the way I played. And it just freed me up to actually play shots and started getting runs, and was sort of, that was at a point too when TCA cricket was such a high standard. I mean, the first grade game I played in, I was one of only two players in that team who hadn't played first class cricket. So we had a whole team full of guys.
I can relate so much. And I think in a way, as again, having the time to reflect on my situation, is that maybe I was progressed too far too early.
Yeah.
Because I wasn't given the opportunity to create the habit of success.
Yeah.
Because I was always obviously trying to reach the highest level that I could perform at. But in doing so, like, I played my first grade cricket match for university at 15 years old. Mm. And I was playing with Tim Payne, James Faulkner, Josh Bean, Rhett Lockyer.
I played against Josh Bean.
Yeah, all of those guys. And the first game I played against was against Sandy Bay, which had George Bailey. Mm. I think Hilf was playing for uni at the time as well. But my first over, I remember Brendan Drew was bowling. First ball, I got hit in the head.
Yeah.
Second ball, I got hit in the dick. And that was my welcome to first grade cricket at uni as well.
See, I actually played my first grade game against uni for Sandy Bay, and I was probably playing against guys that your dad played cricket with. So I opened the batting with Nick Courtney, who was a Launceston boy as well. And in our team, it was, you know, Michael Farrell, Ben Target, Richard Allenby, Stu Saunders. And for uni, it was like Josh Marquette was opening the bowling.
Joshie was still there when I was playing.
Yeah,
still could put him down a bit.
Man, he was so quick back then. Josh Bean played that game as well. So I think all the Sandy Bay guys you would have played against were a bit after my time, because that last year for me was 97, 98, and then I was out of there. But, you know, there's probably not a better game for teaching you life lessons than cricket. You know, one mistake and it's over. You know, drill your skills all the time, and then have a level of detachment once you're executing. And you know, great concepts that you learn around teamwork and operating as part of a team, but also having to really excel as an individual.
It is. It's a beautiful game, but at the same time, it's a kind of a game, because, like you said, you don't get a second chance. And if you're a batsman who doesn't bowl, it's a long weekend.
Bloody oath. So do you think that those pressures that you carried through having the family name ultimately drove you away from your enjoyment and love of sports?
Yeah, definitely. It's been a large contributing factor, and but other people have had bits to do with it as well. Just in terms of, you know, I went to a toffee private school, and unfortunately, my truth and my perception of that experience is that the leaders of that school viewed me as more of a pawn that they could use in their game of building reputation, and rather than necessarily trying to understand me as the kid that I was and help me through whatever I needed assistance with. So, you know, I think it's multifactorial, but it's just, it is what it is, and I don't resent any of it. I don't, like I said, I'm grateful for the parents I have, the life I've had, and all of that, because it's put me on a path to where I am now. And, you know, I've learned to be proud of who I've become and what I'm doing with my day to day, despite obviously everything at the moment being in complete shutdown. So I'm a very, very big believer that everything happens for a reason, and that, you know, we need light, we need darkness to see light, and whatever happens is meant to.
Yeah. And you probably get a lot, you've probably gotten a lot more fulfillment from walking your own path and learning your own lessons and building your own businesses than what you would have done if you just followed in the footsteps and, you know, done the same thing as your dad, I'd imagine.
Well, it doesn't matter. Like, no matter what I would do, even if it was football. So it was a sport that had nothing to do with the success of my father, but you'd achieve something in any sporting field, and it was often tarnished with a brush of somebody saying, yeah, but that's because of your dad. You know what I mean? So in the field of business and where I've gone on my own over here in Victoria, it's just, it hasn't left room for those sorts of things to happen, which has been, I guess, partially important for me to be able to stand on my own 2 feet and do things alone.
Yeah, cool. All right, so let's go back into the fitness side of it. You said that you had a couple of important people in your life with the eating disorder stuff that you struggled to understand, and that really drew you into the fitness side of it. Tell us a bit more about that and how that led you into a full-time career in fitness.
Again, I just think we're in a really weird and unique period of time in history right now. And I think that the face of health and what that actually means is a far different conversation today than what it was 20 years ago and even 10 years ago. And that is because we have so many more things that need consideration if we want to take a full scoped or holistic approach to the individual. So, when we look at the way that we consume food or and where that food even comes from, I think there's a loss of emotional attachment of understanding or appreciating where that food has come from. There's a lot of obviously mass farming practices where foods are animals are fed antibiotics to keep them alive in such poor living conditions. The farmers use pesticides, preservatives and Roundup and things to create the biggest profit yields on their crop. Where we've got a massive exposure to EMF. We've got social media pressures. So, you know, the stats on social media is pretty scary. Like I announced just on my own social media that I'm taking a break from it at the moment because I've been feeling its negative effects on my own mental health while we're in this pandemic, if that's what we want to call it. With the stats showing that the people that spend or the top quartile or 25% of social media users are likely to experience or have a 300% greater likelihood of experiencing clinical depression. And young women spending as little as half an hour on social media a day are going to start having negative perceptions of themselves and their body image. Even that as well, we look at let's look at superhero figures in movies. You look at Batman and Robin from the 80s or the 70s even, and then you look at the figures that they're walking around in today. So there's all these in sort of unrealistic expectations and social pressures for people to look, behave and be a certain way. So again, like I was saying before, there's a physiological response to the psychological response. Where you're experiencing a lot of circadian disruption with long sleep wake cycles, with electricity and artificial light, and the effects that that's having on melatonin, for example. And then, you know, digestive issues is probably one of the most common things that I'm talking with people about today. So again, it's far beyond just cleaning up your food a little bit and moving. Like, yeah, that's the basic of it, and that's what a lot of people just need to be doing. But at the same time, understanding that health now goes beyond just what you put in your mouth. It's what you put in your mind and what you expose yourself to in our environment. And that's probably, in my opinion, one of the biggest influences or biggest roadblocks that's standing in people's way from achieving what they want with their goals.
Yeah, and what you're talking about there, this is all the background stuff that every trainer should know. Every trainer. I think 2006, I got this whole CD series from one of my mentors that I did a lot of education with in the early days, Paul Check. And it was this whole CD
series.
He's
awesome.
Yeah, he's amazing. He was the original educator on all the holistic lifestyle factors. And I went on and did his holistic lifestyle coaches and it covered all this stuff, you know, the commercial farming and EMFs and it's this huge wealth of information that you need to have in the background. And a lot of clients aren't ready for it straight up. A lot of clients, you know, they just need the basics, which is eat, clean up your diet and start moving.
And that's where Charles Poliquin, one of the best things he ever said to me was a confused mind says no.
Yeah, that's right.
And so when we're looking at that delivery of that coaching, you know, you've got to, you know, have a good awareness of where that individual's at and coach them, not beyond what their level of care or need is for that time.
Yeah, totally. Snippets, just drip feeding that info. But you know, you got to have all that knowledge yourself as a coach. Until you understand all those factors, you're not giving yourself the best chance of putting the puzzle of each person together. And each person's a puzzle, right?
Yeah, completely. That's what I mean. There's a colleague of mine, Holly Sinclair, and I. She's very well educated and specializes a lot with female health, with specifics to, I suppose, the reproductive system and any, you know, female specific issues. But we do some seminars and workshops and things together. And one of the recent ones we did, at the bottom of every page, we basically titled the seminar "It Depends," because there is no blueprint that fits all. It's just everybody's looking for that sort of one size fits all approach, but it doesn't exist.
Yeah, bloody oath. It's the intellectually honest answer to just about any health and fitness question.
Yeah, and there's not enough people in our industry willing to say I don't know.
Yeah, you know, one of the best books anyone can read is any of the books from the Freakonomics series. I just read one of them. There's like five or six of them. I just read one called Think Like a Freak. And the whole premise is based off that concept. Humans are terrible at saying, I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
And the market, especially in the health and fitness market, they like absolutes as well. They like absolute answers. What's better, group training or personal training? What's better, high bar squat or low bar squat? What's better, powerlifting or weightlifting? What's better, organic food or conventional food, fresh veggies or snap frozen?
I think one of the important things to allow you to find comfort with saying I don't know is having enough self-awareness to know that where you stand within the industry and within your abilities. So I know I'm never going to be, you know, a Charles Poliquin. Like that's ridiculous. But I do know that what I can achieve with a support network and other good people around me in a team is far greater than what I can achieve by myself. So by me saying, I can say I don't know, but I can find out for you because I've positioned myself with the right people around me that I can ask and, you know, use them as a resource. But at the end of the day, it's just as valuable for the client.
Totally, totally. I have some thoughts. Let me get back to you. I have some thoughts. Let me organize them. I'm going to get back to you.
Exactly.
Totally. All right. So when you started out, what was your first PT gig? Where did you start working?
I did a very short stint, but it was more of a work placement thing out at, there was a little bit of a group training business that was running out of a little space under the Southern Stand at what's now Blunston Arena, but I wouldn't have actually called that so much of a job. My first actual probably job was in Zap Fitness there, in Liverpool Street as a sole trader. I think I was 17 or just turned 18 years old. And like most personal trainers at that age, thought, yeah, I've got this down pat. I've been banging around in this hardcore gym with some big boys for a couple of years now. I've got my BCAAs, which are a fucking waste of money, but I'm going to promote the fuck out of them. And went about trying to find myself some clients from the treadmill platform. And that's where it started. And that's where I actually met you.
That's right. 2013, I believe that was.
Maybe I can't recall, but it might have been because I moved to Melbourne pretty much about then.
Yeah, so I moved back to Hobart in April 2013. So I did 6 months with that organisation, and then went and opened up my own thing about the same or just after you went to Melbourne, I think.
Yeah.
And so you went off to Melbourne then, and you opened your first business over there, which was Gripped PT.
Yeah. So essentially I think you know Chris Cochran, don't you, Charles?
Yeah. Yeah, I do.
Yeah. So I had him on my podcast, which was a really fun chat because we both
listened to that. Share. It was good. It was really good.
Yeah. We've both had enough fuck ups in our time to have a good laugh at them now. And we've had a few of those fuck ups together. But he was doing rapid PT. up in Sydney through Anytime Fitness, where I took inspiration from his model and wanted to do something quite similar in the Melbourne market. And, you know, Zap Fitness was the monopoly, essentially, in Hobart, and they started to expand into the Victorian market. So when they did so, I had a couple of years of industry experience by then and was confident in my abilities to come across and fill the books of myself and then subcontract trainers to work for me under the personal training company Gripped, where, you know, again, I would basically run it like a trade. So that was starting off all right. I was in the Flemington location off Racecourse Road there, which was one of their biggest clubs over here at the time, and managed to set up a trainer out there. And then they were opening a new studio at the top of the city in Victoria Street, where they promised, 1,000 members on opening. And I think they ended up opening with maybe 100, 150. So again, I'd sort of not did my ass, but again, they were all part of the learning experience. And I bought a couple of trainers on expecting that gym to be pumping, which it wasn't, which led me to giving them the work instead of my own PT, which obviously then I'm losing commission out of, but needed to do so for the security of those staff members, and was just becoming very, very frustrated with the lack of cooperation I was getting from the gym. They didn't seem to understand that in a business model that's low entry of $11 a week or whatever, with no locking contracts, that their only retention tool beyond the facility is probably results and personal training.
I think we shared those frustrations at the time.
Yeah, and that facility itself isn't strong enough for that client retention, because to me, I would describe it as it's like a dentistry gym. It's got that white light, very sterile, no attitude at all. So after frustrations reaching, I suppose, boiling point, I decided to go out on my own and create my own facility, group training facility. And we spent a number of years just reinvesting any revenue back into that facility to make it bigger and better. And after nearly 5 years of service towards that goal, well, probably longer actually, because I think Melbourne 2013, where I started Gripped, then the gym itself opened at the end of 2014. And then I left in April 2019, which was a very quick turnaround. And I took the lease for the facility, of which is now Jungle HQ, in June, and opened September the 9th. September the 7th, we ran a seminar, and September the 9th was the first Monday open for business.
Yeah.
So awesome. it's been a pretty busy 24 months.
Bloody oath. Hey, when I first moved back to Hobart, I think it might have been you soon after I met you, and I said, you know, I grew up here, but I've been in Sydney for a long time. I think you asked me if I knew Chris Cochran, and it was funny, you know, because I knew everyone in the fitness industry in Sydney, but I hadn't heard of Chris. And you said, yeah, Chris, he's got this business Rapid, and you told me all about it, and I was dumbfounded that could be the case, and I didn't know who he was, but I really enjoyed that episode that you and Chris did, and he's trained at my gym a few times when he comes down. It always struck me what a difficult business model that was. It's hard enough managing trainers within your own gym where you've got eyes on every day, to go and then extrapolate that over, you know, the space of a city or, in his case, the whole country. That's an extremely hard thing to manage.
But yeah, like we said on the podcast, confidence and self-belief was never really a limiting factor to Chop. So like, good on him. And that's probably why for such a long time he did manage to do quite well for himself until it sort of reached its tipping point. But again, that all came with, by the sounds of it, extremely valuable lessons for him and greater understanding of who he is as an individual and where he wants to be going now.
Yeah, bloody oath. And look, business like sport is a great teacher. What are some of the big things you've learnt yourself through those early days, more so at Gripped? We'll move into what you're doing at Jungle HQ in a minute, but what are some of the big training lessons and business lessons you've learned through those formative years in business?
One that's standing out to me is probably the lessons I learnt surrounding relationships, partnerships, and being very clear from the get-go about what one another's roles and responsibilities are, what those roles and responsibilities are worth in terms of remuneration or equity. They're probably the biggest ones, because I was very young when I went into that business. It was with a friend. It was a lot more on a handshake agreement than a legal one, which potentially was probably one of the biggest causes for the lack of transparency or grey area / differences of opinion come later years. So that's been a huge lesson. We were only talking on the phone last night, and you said it yourself. I think that people were, what did you say? People were only loyal to their own agenda.
Yes. So
what were the words you used?
So loyalty is a nice concept that everyone thinks they understand the meaning of, but the reality is, especially in business, people are only ever loyal to their own values and their own outcomes. And that doesn't necessarily mean there's a bad person, but what it does mean is that in any business relationship, you have to have it written down on paper. And you know, I've seen this many, many times. I've been in situations where you come to a point and one party is saying, "Well, I thought this," and the other party is saying, "But I thought this." And in the absence of anything being written down, you've then got a conflict. The beauty of contracts. And I place contracts in the same category as sales, for example. So you'll find uneducated, uninvolved people in business say things like, "I hate sales," or "I hate selling." As soon as I hear that, I think you're a dummy. You're an absolute dummy, because we're all selling.
It gets a sleazy rap anyway. You should only feel that way about sales if you're being a scumbag. You shouldn't feel guilty about selling somebody a value that they want.
Yeah, sales is the highest order of service. It's the highest order of service you can give someone. And if you're good at sales, what you're actually doing is you're helping that person make a decision that's in their best outcome, and you're helping them align with something that's going to help them in their life. There's nothing salesy about it. You don't have to be sleazy. You don't have to be unethical, but you got to be good. You got to be good at what you do. You got to be good at recognizing what they're saying and aligning that with what they need. And contracts are the same.
I also find that sales has taken a bit of a journey in the way that, like, you know, in your career in the industry, obviously there's levels to this stuff, and you earn a right or a position to pick and choose a little bit more. So in the earlier days of, you know, when Gripped was starting out in the Zap facilities, and what you're trying to do is really drive sales to get those books full for yourself and for your trainers. You do sell with a fair bit of what's the word I'm looking for? Just
need. You got to,
there's a lot of velocity almost in the way that you're approaching your sales, and that's your driving force. Whereas now that, you know, you've established yourself within the market, I've got a reputation in the industry. The sales is almost done a little bit more for yourself, and you find the clients are the one that are selling more towards you because they're applying. And again, I've earned my right to be in a position where I get to pick and choose a little bit more the clients that I work with. And I don't do that out of anything personal of not liking the individual. It's more just understanding that, look, for what you're wanting, you may be better off with somebody who's within my team that's not going to be at such a high price bracket, because you only need the simple basics and we can pass down guidance and advice on there. Or there's just people that just aren't necessarily in my niche. Like, you know, if somebody comes to me and wants to be wants to get on stage as a bodybuilder, like, sure, I could help them do that. And I have done that, but it's not my niche and it's not where I get enjoyment out of it. And I believe you'd be in far better hands with somebody who specializes in that field. And I think you actually, again, earn further respect and get closer to the position that I'm in now by doing that and telling people no.
Yeah, and that's exactly what I said. You know, sales is aligning people with what's in their best interest. You know, and if it's not with you, it might be with someone else. But the contract piece, and when we're talking about relationships in business, it's the same thing. You know, I've heard business owners, and I've heard people, you know, who are in these subcontracting situations saying, "Oh, you know, we do everything on a handshake. We don't like contracts. If we can't just do it on a handshake, then it's all too complicated." No, there has to be a contract. Like I said, I've seen these situations and been in these situations where you get to a point and it's, oh, I thought this, and the other person's saying, I thought this, and you've got to have that bit of paper that you go back to and you say, well, what does the bit of paper say?
Yeah, and when I say no handshake agreement, there was an original contract that was made, which was very, very basic, and signed upon between two people. But at the same time, like I said, I think I was 22 years old. And so there's no guarantees in business, and this was a brand new venture, and we didn't know what would come of it. So it was like, fuck it, let's give it a go. Let's see what happens. And that time there was love in the relationship. And then the thing that happened is that, like all contracts, at some stage with when businesses evolve, contracts need to be revisited. When you're getting resistance to that renegotiation or that revisiting, because the other party understands that that's probably not going to land on the favorable side for them, it becomes very, very difficult to renegotiate once the runs are already sort of starting to appear on the board. So yeah. Lots of lessons.
Yeah, my word. All right, so you... That's one of the lessons. What are some of the other lessons you've learned through those formative years? Some of the big ones.
One of the things that I've definitely learned is probably to let go of fear of judgment from other people, and that could be held in a few different contexts. So, firstly, the fear of judgment is what can hold you back in terms of possessing the confidence to put yourself out there, whether it be on camera, on social media, or just, you know, within your brand. And secondly, I don't need the approval or the acceptance of other people to say what I say and believe what I believe. I don't ever intend to offend somebody, but at the end of the day, offense can only be taken, not given. So, I'm not too upset that if you don't like me. So I've become, like I said, I've done a lot of work looking inward after, you know, challenges with understanding my identity and self, having experienced some failures or shortcomings in what I believed was going to be my future in sport. And within that self-awareness has come with the confidence to be who I want and say what I want and leave the judgment up to other people. So in a way, my previous work environment that led me to becoming, I suppose, detached from it was that, you know, I'm on a path of continual expansion and evolving, and I like to, you know, I'm continually trying to learn and better at what I do. And when other people aren't on that same mission, you know, you can drift in different directions. And then when somebody, and then the people start to become uncomfortable for whatever reasons it may be about your, expression or of opinion, you know, it creates a bit of a shaky ground to stand on. And I can only take responsibility from me stepping back from within my presence in the studio, which allowed other people more time to have influence on its culture, which ultimately had led me to the position where I didn't feel at place within my own business that I created. And that's what left the space for the brand and the name Jungle HQ to be born, because when we look at what's within a jungle, and I'm a bit of a nature head and I love animals, and so there's a connection there too. But when we look at what's in the jungle, it's diversity. And I was really fed up with being in an environment that sort of, I would describe now, for those that know Melbourne very well, very South Yarra, very bit snooty. You had to sort of be a certain individual to probably feel comfortable within the space. I just didn't like it. So the word jungle, I suppose, is meant to represent radical acceptance of individuality. And that's exactly what I'm looking for within the members, my trainers, is that it's a space where people can express themselves through the form of exercise and connection with other people. And that's why the floors are polished concrete, so you can spew shit on the floor, I don't care. And you know, you've got a place to do that in, and there is no judgment there, and it's the diversity of culture and individuals which makes it a special place, because we can learn so many more things and gain perspectives from those unique outlooks from everyone.
Yeah, man. There's a whole heap of things there that just really touch on why business relationships are so bloody hard. You know, there's so many dynamics or so many forks in the road where it can go bad. I mean, one of them is, you know, to the degree that you're growth orientated. So you're talking there about how you're always constantly learning and looking to level up and improve your own game. To the degree that you're growth orientated as a business owner, you're going to trigger people within your organization that aren't. Yeah. So they're going to feel very unsettled by the speed at which you change, by how differently you see things, by how big your goals might be compared to them. On the same hand, if you've got people within your organization who are subcontractors or employees, if they're growth focused in a way that's not in alignment with your organization, that's going to create friction as well. And then, you know, when it comes to partnerships, if you guys don't have the same vision for what you're doing, it's near on impossible. And if there's one thing that I would encourage any business owner to do, it's to run your business how you want to. And if somebody's not willing to fall in line with that, it's not the place for them. And that's okay. It doesn't make them a bad person. It's probably just that they're better off not there. And by the sounds of it, you've got a very unique idea of what you want Jungle HQ to be, and it's very different to what you were doing in your previous business. But now that it's yours, it's totally yours, you get to be the master of that. And it doesn't matter what other people think, it doesn't matter what they think about what you say, none of that stuff matters, because it's yours.
No, it's one of the things that it sounds like a strange thing to have celebrated and been happy about, but on my podcast I got a 1-star review, and I was stoked, because I certainly don't aim to please everybody. I believe the quickest way for me to fail would be do exactly that. So as many people as I rub the wrong way with my, I suppose, willingness to be outspoken and say what I really mean, you know, you get just as many, they're not the people that are going to buy from me anyway. So from business, as many people as you put offside, you're going to get just as many on the other gravitate towards you even more so than if you just sat in the middle as a mediocre. So
I would say 10 times
I'm
more.
Cool with that. Yeah.
For every person you upset, there'll be 10 times the people who you resonate with.
Yeah. And yeah, so that for me was, that was great.
I mean, the hard thing about that really though is social media. And you touched on it earlier. In one of my early episodes, I talked with Dan Cooper, who's a PhD student in neuroscience and a former Special Forces gunslinger. How's that for a combination of existences in one life? And he was talking about some of the data on social media, and he's saying there's pretty much nothing good about it. You know, using social media, there's pretty much nothing good about it. And if you think about the difference in how it feels to have, say, a disagreement or a dispute or a or a confrontation in real life, I think you're much like me, you know, you don't have a problem with conflict versus what it feels like when it's social media based. They're totally different things, right?
There's a lot of people with big balls behind keyboards.
That's right. That's right. But, you know, and it magnifies it. It becomes this thing that, you know, if you're dealing with it in person, it's really not even a thing.
And that's a constant battle for me to just detach my ego from the need to prove them wrong and maybe right. And again, just try and remind myself that I don't need the acceptance and approval of other people to believe what I believe and say what I say, you know?
Yeah, I mean, you're giving up your agency for contentment and happiness. If you need someone's praise or acceptance to be happy, that's the same. It's the opposite side of that same coin.
And it's interesting that what you just said there, because again, we've kind of identified is that I was in a very different position in terms of the journey that I'm on for self-development and progression that didn't align with the team that was in my previous business.
Mm.
And that, you know, came with its own battles of personal feelings of, being unappreciated for what you do, for the value that you bring and the lessons that you try and pass on. Whereas the contrast right now is like night and day. And I'm very, very fortunate that I've got to have that fresh start and build my team from the ground up. And now I'm surrounded with seven really good guys that don't feel threatened by one another, that are continually used. We're all our own sole traders, which come together as a unit to support one another's growth and businesses. And it's a completely different situation. And when we've been talking about lessons that I learned along the way in business, and one of those, and this is going to be a permanent tug of war for me, is that money doesn't necessarily mean happiness. But because I was in a position where the reality is I was towards the end of my years at Gripped, I was probably only putting in maybe 20 hours of work a week, if I'm honest, of honest work a week. You know, I was pulling myself a really good wage, and you know, the business was paying for my you know, my Mercedes four-wheel drive. And so I had all these things that have the perception of success, but I was miserable. I probably had a 6-month period where the people that were closest to me were calling me and asking me if I was okay. And at the time, I was really confused about why they were even making these calls, and thought that they were crazy. Or I was becoming frustrated. Like, people were talking shit. But until I'd actually stepped away, and now it all kind of clicked and goes, oh, now I can actually see why these people were asking me that. And then here I am in a venture of a new business. And at the end of the day, your business's sole objective is to be profitable.
Mm.
So you're doing everything you can to make money, but then it's hard for me personally to not get caught in the trap of money, 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 and realizing that I need to find my sweet spot. And it's going to be forever moving needle back and forth of what the balance sits well with me in terms of lifestyle, in terms of my own physical condition and fitness, and my sort of spiritual happiness and well-being. So it's a really tough thing for me as a young man in business to not get caught up in the superficial.
Yeah, and having a relationship and awareness around what money actually is and what it does for you. I mean, you know, that really helped me. I remember, you know, building my business, I was so needy for the success that I wanted to have. And, you know, both from a point of saying, you know, I've built this thing, look at this thing I've built. It's a concept that, you know, you dream of. And as a PT on the floor back in the day, if someone had said to me, all right, one day you'll have your own gym, you'll have 600 members, you'll be generating this much revenue and you'll be getting paid this much, that would have been for me just, I've made it. And so that neediness, is, I suppose, as I was building that neediness for that success came with a lot of lessons along the way. And it taught me a lot about my relationship with money. And I'm highly motivated by money. But what I've learned through that process is that my motivation, or the way that money motivates me, really is the connection to me of what money means. So for me, money means being able to provide for my family, being able to take my kids on holidays, being able to invest in a way that builds legacy for my family. And, you know, it's not flashy stuff. I mean, I've got a nice car, but apart from that, I don't go out on weekends. You know, I'm not buying expensive clothes all the time, hardly ever.
Even that work you said about your car, right? Like, I understand that is, it's, you know, it's not necessary, but it's nice.
Yeah.
And for me, getting into a nice car in the morning, it's about the way that feels within myself.
Yeah.
And that's a constant reminder of you've earned this and you need to keep working hard to maintain these feelings that I feel right now with this kind of freedom I have in my life, because I'm not constrained or restricted by money. That is my oxygen to do what I want in my life.
Yeah, totally. I mean, I didn't get a nice car until I was well into my 30s. The first 2 years of GTT being in business, I was still driving a banged up old Suzuki Swift, because, you know, at that point, my focus was on building this thing, which gave me the ability to do that. And I think we'd been going for 2 or 3 years when I bought a new Jag XE, and it was great.
I remember when you got it,
Yeah, it was great. It was like, it was that exact thing, you know, after doing a 12-hour day, I got to get into a nice car to go home. And, you know, a couple of years after having that, Alana and I were walking past a car yard one day and we saw this really nice BMW X4, and she was like, that'd be a great car for you. And I was like, it would be. And for the first time in my life, I was in a position where I could just make that decision on a dime, and I could say, right, I'm going to trade in and I'm going to get that car. But
like you said, look how long you've worked for to be able to earn that privilege.
That's right. And you know what? I've got a really good perspective on what it actually means. And all it is that, you know, I mean, I don't even notice it each day now. I get in my car and I drive to work and I drive home, and it makes absolutely no difference to how happy I am or where I'm at. I could, you know, my business could go under and I could lose that car, but as long as I've still got my family and I can put food on the table, I'm happy. You know, it actually makes no material difference to my happiness. It's just a perk that I get to enjoy because of all the work that I've done. And that's all it is. And the money piece of it, you know, to tie it back into what you're talking about, the money side of it can become very hollow if you're not getting fulfillment from the thing that's getting you that money.
And mate, to be honest, one of the things that's really helped me dissolve that ego, or work through those battles to form an identity of oneself, has probably been some experimentation with psychedelics and psilocybin mushrooms and those kinds of things. So I don't know about you, whether or not you've ever dabbled in that pathway, but you know, that's been I mean, everybody in the world's obsessed with experiences.
Yeah.
You know, you go to the fucking Grand Canyon or Niagara Falls, you go skydiving. Yeah, that's cool. But have you ever been lost inside your own subconscious mind for 5 hours?
Oh, that's interesting.
So when we look at that, you know, like we have about 60,000 thoughts per day. And 96% of those thoughts are subconscious. So we're not consciously aware of them. And then we look at the current health status of society, and, you know, anxiety and depression are through the roof, higher than they've ever been before. And a large part of that's probably because people, essentially to me, anxiety is an understanding of, it's a resistance to a feeling, or that I'm living my life in the past or in the future that hasn't even happened yet. So until we, and our emotional reaction to certain experiences or in life is due to the subconscious mind. And so until we actually put the conscious mind to sleep and gain awareness, create order, and sort of disrupt that inner identity that is unwell, destabilizing somebody's sense of self and reorganizing those experiences in our mind, that can be a long-lasting ongoing issue for you. So, you know, that can obviously be achieved through meditation as well. But, you know, I fully understand and have no problems speaking about the controversy of the use of such substances in their therapeutic doses.
Well, I had a little mushroom trip once upon a time, and I'm sure it healed me, or it cured me of the desire and the want to binge drink on weekends. So I used to, I've gone through phases in my life where, you know, you're playing sport or whatever, and you're hitting the piss every weekend. And at times I definitely felt powerless over alcohol. I'd come up to the weekend, I'd be like, can't drink this weekend. You play footy, you'd have a beer. Next minute it's 3 o'clock in the morning and you've been out a weekend and you've fucked the next week. And so I've definitely felt that powerlessness. And can't remember what year it was, but anyway, one of my mates and I, we took some mushrooms, and it was weird. Like, I started having dreams in the days after it, having these mm-hmm. dreams of like a schooner being presented to me. I'd just be repulsed by it. And it triggered something in my brain where I found subconsciously I was just finding ways not to drink thereafter. And I've through my 30s, I think I could probably count on one hand the amount of times I've got pissy. Really, I turned 40 last week, and I've hardly.
Yeah, I don't really drink anymore. I obviously, and I think that's a really hard thing for young men, particularly in Australia, because it's such a big part of our culture. Mm. And you're gonna, and so is taking the piss out of each other. So if you choose to go against the grain there, and decide that alcohol isn't necessarily a good combination for you, that can be. That can come with its own challenges of sort of creating separation within yourself from certain groups. But I'm not surprised to hear your experiences, because I've done a lot of reading into like Timothy Leary from his Harvard studies in 1960, Dr. Roland Griffiths, who's got a PhD and professor of psychiatry and neuroscience, and then more recently like Terence McKenna. And so he's done a lot of the research. They're experimenting with psilocybin mushrooms, and they consider... And they've seen great therapeutic effects in terms of anxiety in terminally ill patients, PTSD for obviously war veterans. So they've done some of that with MDMA as well. Addiction for smoking cessation particularly. So the alcohol would probably be, related to that kind of outcome. And then depression. So, you know, trauma's in the brain. Mm. And when they look at the dosage, right, they consider half a gram a microdose, which is almost they've labeled like problem solving. So it's like a creative spark. You're not necessarily going to have hallucinogenic effects. And then a therapeutic dose being more of around the 2 gram mark, and then they call the spiritual dose, or Terence McKenna labeled it the heroic dose, as 5.5 grams of a spiritual dose. But there's been recorded studies in the literature of people having up to 8 grams. And I can say from personal experience, that is a mind splitting experience that was certainly challenging, but it has come with great value. And I'm not here advocating and recommending everybody that's feeling stressed or anxious at the moment to go dive themselves into a bunch of psychedelic mushrooms, because that's pretty irresponsible if you're not familiar with that realm, so to speak. Because if we look at Maslow's hierarchy of needs, the top there we've got food and water, and then the second one there is safety. And there is nothing that feels safe about the unknown of that realm of consciousness if you're not familiar with it. So please, if anyone's listening, don't take my advice and just be an idiot like I am. But I certainly feel quite strongly, and it's things that we've spoken about before in some of these seminars that we did. We did one called Taboo Truths, where we looked into the controversy that surrounds not just recreational drugs, but prescription drugs like the contraceptive pill, and even drugs that are just labeled. So, you know, we look at smoking. That's everybody's so caught up in this world of right and wrong, legal and illegal, and that's how they live their life rather than their own common sense or morality. And we look at smoking, okay, that's legal, but it kills 480,000 people a year in the United States alone. We're in lockdown at the moment, but the bottle shops are still open.
Yeah.
Okay, so 88,000, with 2/3 of those 88,000 in the United States died last year are being men. 750,000 deaths related to opioid use in the last 20 years, and that's exponentially increasing. And these are all prescription things. Yet we've had one cannabis death last year, and that was from vaping THC oil.
LSD had zero. And then I know methamphetamines and cocaine, and that falls somewhere in the middle there of around 20,000-25,000 as well. So we're looking at the things that are legal and illegal here, right or wrong. But let's look at the data. And when you look at things like psilocybin mushrooms, psychedelic experiences, which we've been told by government are dangerous and harmful, well, objectively, that's hard to stand behind.
So how did you find that psychedelics helped you?
They definitely have helped me realign my value systems of understanding what makes me tick, who I am at the roots of myself, and find acceptance and love for who that person really is. And I guess, like we said, like we're wrestling with that tug of war about viewing finances as your metric for success. But yeah, just definitely has dissolved some ego, has aligned my value systems, has given me greater depths of self-awareness. So again, when I understand what those, I mentioned it before about emotional reactions to certain situations based on your subconscious mind, when I've actually had the opportunity to go inward and slow down, create order and organization within those thoughts, the just in understanding where the emotional reaction comes from, whether that be jealousy, whether that be anger, whether that be sadness, just having understanding of where that's actually coming from is enough to often dissolve its volcanic detriment at times. So I would say an overall greater sense of calmness within myself. It's probably continued to magnify my ability to live a life that's expressing what I really actually want to be doing and what I'm passionate about.
Yeah, cool. Very cool. All right, so Jungle HQ kicked off September 2019. Mate, tell us a bit more about it. Obviously, you've told us we can shit, piss, spit on the floor. What else is happening there?
At the moment, fuck all. Because we're in lockdowns here in Melbourne, and I mean,
fuck. Man, I feel so sorry for you guys over there. I mean, on so many levels. We were locked down for 11 weeks, and it was just, I think from a business owner's perspective, the thing I found hardest was the uncertainty of how long it was going to go for.
Yeah.
What sort of business I'll have left at the end of it, if any.
And that still exists because I've lost complete trust, as have so many people in the government.
Yeah.
Not that I necessarily had a heap of trust there in the first place, but the thing that's really annoying me is that if you are in a position to influence and control an entire country with your decision-making, in my opinion, it is expected that you have access and the resources to the best information available. And it doesn't seem that the best information has been sought and utilized. And in response to that, decisions have been made that have brought consequences to be worn by us as a community or a society rather than the people in charge that are making them. There seems to be no accountability and no consequence for the people at the top. And if this is the transparency is non-existent.
Yeah.
If this is about health, which is what you're standing behind, which I don't believe it is, then let's tell the full story. Because I saw a stat, it was on the 13th or 14th week of lockdown. I think we're well exceeded that now here in Melbourne, and we're going to be up to 20 at least by the time business returns. So in that 13th week or something, the average suicide rate was 76 more people a week than COVID. So if this is about health, let's have a look at the systemic effect that this is having throughout the population and address it and have a conversation about it. Because who the fuck are you to make an executive decision that we as a community are not strong enough to handle that truth? So that's my stance on it. And it's really, really frustrating. I feel like my hands are tied. There's so many sort of hypocritical and contradictory decisions out there. The fact that hair salons have been allowed to operate up until today, this entire time, has just got me baffled. you know, people have been allowed to operate outside in a personal training environment, yet I have a warehouse that has two roller doors that essentially remove an entire wall. So that makes it basically outdoors and undercover. There's been no use of common sense. There's been just changing minds constantly. There's one week Dan Andrews is on the fucking news telling people don't use a face mask, it's an absolute waste. The next week you're now telling us that we're going to get fined $4,100 or something if we're seen outside without one outside of curfew or something. Like, and you're going to fine people in a time where we're in the biggest economic crisis that people of my generation have seen. Yeah. And you've taken a pay rise? Fuck me. How do you expect people to respect that?
First thing, fuck Dan Andrews. I fucking hate that guy. He's such a condescending fuckwit.
I've been sending him some hail through the social media before I got off there.
He's a fucking arsehole. You know, this whole thing, Australia was so close to getting past it. And his fuck up with those quarantine hotels is what has led to this. And he gets up in those press conferences and blames young people, blames the aged care system,
blames everyone,
but doesn't take himself. And I can't help but feel that this whole crisis is more complex than what most people can understand. And there's definitely an element of the Dunning-Kruger effect where we see what we see and we go, well, you know, you talked about information. We see what we see and we go, well, this is fucked because... So I think there's a whole nother element. I've been trying to understand it from every angle. I've been listening to a virologist podcast where they talk about the virus. I've been listening to getting information from a whole heap of different angles. But my feel on it is that this is a really bad combination of politics and media. It's obviously great business for the news. And for the politicians... I mean, I don't think anything's been politicised as much as this since Gough Whitlam got ousted in whatever year it was in the 70s. It's the most politicised event ever. And, you know, people say, well, you can't put a cost on lives. We do every day. So, you know, life insurance is a cost on lives. Victims of crime payments, that's a cost on lives. We put a cost on lives all the time. And at the moment, we're putting an outrageously high cost on lives. And the most missed factor in this whole thing is that governments have been getting warned by scientists for a long time now that there will be a pandemic and they need to be prepared. And basically $0 have gone into that. And so what I don't understand is if we can have a standing army in case there's a war one day, which we spend billions on, why can't we have a standing medical response capacity, maybe a pandemic hospital, which certain, you know, healthcare professionals rotate through and it could sit empty, like our, you know, our military bases. Hey, I was in the army for 8 years. We did a bit of training, but we did a lot of fuck all, let me tell you. And we got paid well to do fuck all, you know, for young men, got paid well. I wouldn't want to be on that money now. But the point I'm making is that a society... All the money we've saved by not having that capacity in our medical system, we're well and truly fucking behind now through having to deal with this in the way we have, which is knee-jerk politics of shut everything down.
Yeah. And I might, my views might be, you know, others, again, might not agree with it. And my emotions are most definitely magnified. So I have to identify my bias there because of what's happening in the business, but I feel a little bit more savagery towards it. It's like this is how life is. Life only exists through death with anything, and people die. Last year, more people died from the flu than would have died from COVID, but we didn't shut down the economy. So the actions are just not matching up with the stats. And yeah, there's like, I get it. It's not a choice. People don't get a choice in this. But again, it's just if you're saying that this is about lives and you're saying this is about health, the average age of COVID-related death is older than the average age of death. And yes, I know old people's lives matter too, but you're crippling the lives and the future of people that have got a whole life ahead of them.
Yeah.
And you like, it's just, where do we draw the line?
That's right. That's the question. The answer,
survival of the fittest, you know, people have died for forever. That's what happens.
Well, since when did we have a right to live till 90? No one's got a God-given right to be live honest, till 90.
I probably won't want to be fucking alive at 90. If I can't wipe my own ass, I've had enough.
Yeah. It's, look, I think that the answer, the heroic answer to this whole problem is levels above the heroism of any politician. And that's what makes it really hard. And here's the thing. If we did the Sweden thing and we let it run and we said to everyone, all right, take your own risk. You got to wear masks, but you can go to the gym. You can go to the shops. If you're vulnerable, stay home. Yeah, a lot more people are going to die. But the alternative, which is what we're suffering now, I mean, I think it's a really strong argument.
That's what I mean. Look how many people are dying from suicide, though. So if it's about saving people's lives, what's killing more people at the moment?
Well, at the moment it's suicide, but if you let this thing run, there would be thousands of deaths from COVID.
That's true.
But, you know, the other side of that is, yeah, there would be thousands of deaths, but, you know, from what I see, parts of the world where it is running more, you're seeing a decrease. So there certainly hits a point where the virus starts to decrease in its
and the rate why of spread. Why is there no there's no information being communicated? If anything, it's being censored around the things that can prevent or improve your chances of defeating the virus if you do contract it. Like, I'm pretty sure 96% of the people that contracted coronavirus in the United States have a study. This was Dr. Rhonda Patrick telling these stories, that 96% of them were vitamin D deficient. So why are we not looking at that? And you're being told, stay inside, wash your hands, ruin the microbiome that's a part of your immune system.
Yeah.
It's all just, it just doesn't make any fucking sense.
And here's the other one. Highest risk factor, obesity. Age, then obesity.
Exactly. So all these people that are dying, they've got a lot of underlying health issues, most likely. So, I don't know.
I'm for either doing a fucking hard lockdown and actually getting rid of it, which is what we probably should have done at the start.
16 weeks ago.
Yeah. Or letting everyone take their own risk. This in between ground, it's not going to work because let's say it takes another year before there's a vaccine available. What are we going to do? Keep going in and out of the lockdown? You can't do that.
I don't want your vaccine anyway.
I don't know.
That's a whole nother conversation.
Yeah, that's a whole nother topic. I'll have it. I'll have it when there's a vaccine. I believe in the science. I think that the reward outweighs the risk. I'm in contact with a lot of people. I would have it. But what are we going to do until there's a vaccine? We're going to keep going in and out of lockdown? You can't. You can't do it. They talk about having to learn to live with this virus and, you know, increasing ICU capacity. And that was the narrative in the first lockdown. Yet here you guys are being locked down again. Why? I thought we were having to learn to live with the virus.
Yeah. And it's hard too when you see that mainstream media have just been, you know, caught out again, like spreading fear by sharing footage of hospitals that aren't even in this country.
Yeah.
Overwhelmed hospitals that aren't even in this country, just to try and drive a narrative.
Yeah, Mark Otterborough shared some stats this morning on Facebook around where the Melbourne hospital system is at as far as people admitted, people in ICU, and it's very, very low. I think there's 37 people in ICU.
One of my close clients is an anaesthetist at the Alfred, which is the biggest hospital here in Melbourne, and man, it's under control. Like, there's a few younger people now that have been suffering, but again,
probably
the numbers.
Up on the weekend.
Exactly. What else is going on in their life? Like the numbers are too small, in my opinion, for the actions that are being taken.
Mm. Yeah, man, I'm with you. Hopefully, fuck. I hope against all hope that it's 6 weeks, this increased level, and it allows them to get on.
But
top
we were talking, about jungle before. That's how we actually got to that. But
let's get back to that. Like,
yeah, so opened September and pretty much got well, yeah, just about 6 months worth of operation. And anybody who started a business understands the profit isn't from day one. So it took me time, took me a good 4.5 months to build the business with members, with clientele, with trainers within the space, to get myself in a position where I could actually make some profit. And then we got shut down, and then we got opened back up, what, a month ago for about 2.5 weeks. So essentially I've been, you know, living half a year off 6 weeks profit, which is tight. So it's just, it, at the same time, you know, it's a bittersweet. It's the whole thing's bittersweet. It's great because I can see that my business model, so those 2 weeks that we opened back up were the busiest 2 weeks I've had since the business was created. So I can see that I've got a successful business model. And that's really exciting and comforting, because it gives me the reassurance and the confidence that I just need to sit tight and do it and then do to make it through to the other side so that that can blossom. But it's just, it's a pure cock tease, mate, because I've just not been given any space to stretch the legs.
Don't worry about it. I mean, I'm sure the politicians and the bureaucrats and policymakers are sitting pretty on their 300K salaries. You've got to wonder, that's a conflict of interest, isn't it? Most of them would be high risk factor. Over 50, overweight, unfit, making policy on it.
Sounds like a politician.
Mm.
And again, that's the thing. They've not been, how many of those politicians have owned businesses? You tell a cafe that they can run at 50%, they're fucking losing money. Their profit margins are about 13%.
Yeah, they've got no skin in the game. The only skin in the game they've got is the fear of what it does to their ratings if people are dying. That's the only skin in the game. Fuck that. All right, so what's your ethos there at Jungle HQ? What sort of approach are you taking with the people that come into your facility and work with you there?
Well, like I said earlier, the brand name is meant to represent radical acceptance of individuality. So with that exact reason, I don't identify as any specific niche of training, whether that be powerlifting, whether it be bodybuilding, whether it be CrossFit, or just, I suppose, general population, general fitness. I think you'll agree on me with this as well, is that the longer and longer I spend in the industry and deal with more and more people, that I believe that everybody needs a little bit of everything, and that be a little bit of strength training, a little bit of cardiovascular training, probably a little bit of mobility and yoga work, to be well-rounded, healthy mind, body, spirit. And I've created a facility there that will allow for people to, you know, reach their goals, whether that be powerlifting, whether that be bodybuilding, given the gear that we've got in there, or whether it be some of that general fitness. I too, much like you, have a bit of a passion for martial arts. And that's something that's always held really important to me as well, is that not just, you know, it's fun being big and strong and looking like a veiny foreskin, but if you can't fucking do anything with your body, then what's the point of having all those muscles? So holding on to my athletic ability is extremely important to me. So, you know, I enjoy boxing and I enjoy jiu-jitsu. And so a lot of my training is, it's a blend these days. And, I think as the owner and the face of the business, you know, I have the ability to influence people. And that seems to be true in terms of the members that come on and the conversations that we have and the reasoning behind my goals with my body, and just providing that perspective. So the business model has a small membership base, which is tiered across time slots, so they can swipe and come and go in the gym, doesn't need anybody to be there in their time slots allocated. And that's not to restrict anybody from not being able to train. It's just understanding that that people that train seriously typically train at the same time of day anyway in routine. And given it's quite a family vibe there, if there's, you know, times here and there where people have, you know, got days off work or changes in structure, that's always workable. And then at the same time, like what I've learned from my past is what my role within the business isn't to be anyone's boss. I don't like being anyone's boss. I like to work with people, and I see it as my responsibility to manage my environment. So managing my environment looks like being very selective of the people that I allow within those four walls. So it's all about the personalities, because the rest is all teachable. And I'm very much passionate about holding on to a positive and supportive environment that doesn't have judgment, and you know, is a place for people to look forward to going to, where they can actually receive really good health coaching advice, and they're not just your run of your mill PTs, and they take into consideration all of those lifestyle and contributing factors to the world that we live in 2020. That's just not the same as what we were when we were cavemen. You know, a lot of these health issues that we see today are a direct result as of the evolution of industry and technology. So it's just change. And a lot of people, you know, you don't know what you don't know. So people can't care about things that they're not aware of yet. Like, so many people don't know that walking around with their iPhone in their pocket all day is going to be having negative effects on their testosterone. They don't know that sleeping with it next to their head can be putting them in a higher risk category for brain related issues, or and looking at the screen is going to fuck up their melatonin, which could affect their sleep, and essentially is an antioxidant for all the mitochondria in their body. And we're just talking about phones here. So I guess
it's probably why I've got three daughters and one son walking around with a phone in my pocket, I reckon.
Well, yeah, maybe, maybe. But you know what I mean? So that's what Jungle HQ is. It's a small membership base. It's a private coaching facility, and it's one that is welcoming to no specific type of individual, but only those with positive energy and good attitudes that contribute to the culture within the place.
Look, I think you and I are very much on the same page with the fitness side of it. I mean, It feels good to be learning. It feels good to be fit. And when I talk about fit, you know, being developing as many of those capacities as you can: aerobic fitness, strength, bit of muscular hypertrophy, but you know, also be putting it to use in some way. I mean, that's definitely been the biggest learning for me in fitness. You know, veering away from that for a little while as I just got all in on learning about strength training and turning into a muscular cloud with no fitness, the epiphany of relearning how important it is to actually be fit is the biggest fitness lesson I've had. But yeah, man, we're on the same page there. The radical acceptance one there, funny you say it, talk about radical acceptance of individuality, but then, you know, I was thinking, oh geez, you're in for some trouble and some conflict if you go with that, but then covering it later on with vetting the kind of people you let in. So definitely much easier to have that radical acceptance when you've got good people in there.
See, it's interesting. Like I said, as from my beginnings and passion was sort of developed because of women. And so I naturally, and again, being a brother to two sisters with a mother that grew up with three sisters that had a lot of daughters, you know, I've probably got a natural protectiveness over women, and especially have seen it in the gym where they kind of get bullied or feel uncomfortable to use certain areas of the gym. And I will protect that environment. Like I said, that is my job to do so. And I've had, given the facility that I've created, you know, it's an impressive one in terms of the equipment that's within there. And there's some really unique pieces that the bodybuilding community would love to train in. And I'm not saying that bodybuilders aren't welcome. I've got a couple guys that have competed in there. I've got a guy, AJ, who's 140 kilo Maori. He's massive, but he's the most gentle, nicest guy in the world, and it doesn't bother anyone. And I had a few guys from Doherty's, you know, your typical dartboards, just with fucking acne everywhere and pulling their pants down and doing side tricep poses in the mirror in front of the dumbbell rack. I don't want that in there. It changes the entire vibe and feel of the place. And you know, when I tried to communicate some of these some of these concerns that I had with a couple of those personalities and those likes, you know, the reactions I got from them were just flying off the charts and, you know, carrying on. I'm like, well, there you go already. You're showing me that you're that entitled as a bodybuilder that you think that you own the gym. You've already got Doherty's, you've got Derrimut's, you've got every other fucking gym in Melbourne, but you're worried about little old me here in Paran with one gym that you're being told that isn't maybe suitable for you when it's not open to the public. It's a private, private membership and private coaching facility, and this is the kind of behavior you're displaying already, then all you're doing is certifying my decision that I've made to say, I'm sorry, but membership's not available to you.
Yeah. See you later, fuckhead.
Exactly. Exactly.
Mate, can relate to that one. Had that one a few times. Anyway. All right, mate, I'm conscious of time. We're hitting 90 minutes, but awesome to talk with you. I can only share with you my deepest and most sincere hope that you guys get to open up sooner rather than later, and fuck knows what the next 10 weeks or the next 6 months holds for us all, but hopefully you can get back to delivering what it is you do. And you know, you've really come a long way as a fitness professional the time I've known you, and it's obvious how much you've added to your skill set and what a great service you provide. So for anyone who's listening in, is keen to learn a little bit more, where can they find you on the interwebs?
Well, like I said, I'm not actually active on my social media right now, but I will be back after a couple more weeks of detox, given the current circumstances. But jungle_Jack is my Instagram tag. And obviously jungleHQ is the tag for the facility. Both on Instagram is probably my biggest platform. I don't really use Facebook too much. There's my podcast also available on iTunes and Spotify. So the Jungle or the JHQ podcast. And I suppose, yeah, just reaching out to anyone who's you know, you've just been quite complimentary there to, I suppose, my growth and expansion of skills. And I can only attribute that by being surrounded by the right people, with you being one of them, giving me some of my earliest direction and mentoring, mate. So thank you. And anyone who's part of the GGT team. GGT team, sorry, in Hobart, who's ever over in Melbourne when travel opens back up, please let them know that they're welcome to come in on a casual and check out the gym. So, yeah, it's been good talking to you, mate.
You too. Look, I'm definitely keen to come train with you sometime when we're moving again. But in the meantime, look after yourself and thanks for your time today.
Always, mate. Let's talk soon.
Cheers.